You're listening ad-free on Wondery Plus. I was just thinking about wealth and power and realized it should be boring. I mean, if I interrogate the reasons to try and get wealth and power, provided you're not a lunatic, it's so that you can use the wealth and power to make your life better, right? You get to live comfortably. If there's something irksome in your life, you use the money and authority you've gathered to make that thing go away. And by increasing your buffer from annoyances, discomforts, and all the other common sufferings of us plebs, you should be left by yourself, with only the people you enjoy, doing only the things you enjoy. Wealthy, powerful people should be surrounded by family and good friends, playing Wordle and having tea parties. They should be boring, but they're not. Instead, they're often black holes of drama, sucking in intrigue and attention, careening through the universe, destroying everything with their own gravity. And of all the wealthy and powerful, royalty seem to orbit destruction the most, and the podcast Even the Royals is out to prove the point. Today's Saturday matinee features two such black holes, the supermassive King Henry VIII and the luminous Anne Boleyn. Their celestial dance fractured the church, upended European politics, and could probably be blamed for hundreds of thousands of deaths in subsequent executions, rebellions, and religious conflicts. I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow Even the Royals. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
A quick note about our show. We do a lot of research for our stories, but we also aren't your boring high school history class. So some details and scenes are dramatized. And our language might get as loose as a wine-fueled royal banquet. So, Arisha, what do you think is the fastest way to bring down a woman in power?
Ooh. Medieval times, I assume, not currently.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess it's a tale as old as time to bring down a woman in power. I don't know. Say that she's sleeping around. People love to just judge women for that.
We got ourselves a winner, folks.
Oh, did we?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I really was just kind of shooting in the dark there.
No, I mean, listen, whether you're Marie Antoinette or Monica Lewinsky, slut shaming is usually the go-to move for taking down a woman who refuses to stay in her lane. And our royal today was a major victim of this during her time, and she still is today. Mm. So I'm, of course, talking about Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
And she's probably the most well-known of Henry's six wives.
Yeah.
Movies and TV shows always show Anne as a sexy, scheming woman-hater who got what she deserved. Mm. And a lot of people during Anne's time agreed with this. At court, she was called, and I kid you not, the great whore.
Honestly, we should repurpose that. We should take that back and make it like a thing. Because what an honor.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm the great whore. I'm the greatest whore.
Yeah. Not the man who has six wives. No, he's not a whore.
Right. Of course. Yeah. But Anne was many things. She was confident, ambitious, intelligent, and she was also super religious. She actually wasn't even into Henry when she first met him, and she refused to become just another one of his mistresses. But Henry became obsessed with Anne, and when the king wants you, you don't really have a choice. So Anne decides to take lemons and make lemonade. If she's going to give up the goods, she wants something in return, like a crown and the title of Queen of England.
Fair trade.
Yeah. But first, Henry has to get out of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, that saint.
My girl.
I know. Which we know from our last episode requires him to get rid of Catholicism in England, which is no big deal. People usually don't hang on to religion too tightly, so.
The lengths men will go to just not be with their wives is absurd.
I know. But Anne does not sit back and wait for all of this to happen. She refuses to let her fate rest in the hands of others, so she grabs life by the horns. Henry may be the one to burn down his first marriage and the church, but Anne is the one who hands him the matches. It's May 19th, 1536, outside the Tower of London. 35-year-old Anne Boleyn is being led to a scaffold, and she's desperately hoping for a miracle. Her gray gown blows in the wind as she looks around in a panic. She's still holding on to hope that her husband, Henry, will come to his senses and change his mind. Because today is her execution, and he is the one who ordered it. Yesterday, Anne was offered her last rites. The priest told her that only a confession would cleanse her soul of the terrible crime she's been convicted of. But Anne tells the priest the same thing she's told everyone else. She's innocent. Anne was actually supposed to be killed yesterday, but hundreds of her supporters showed up at the tower ready to riot, so her execution was postponed, which must have been excruciating for Anne to be so close to death then have it delayed for another day.
It's like all these people on death row.
I know. But this also lit a small fire of hope in her. If this many people believe in her innocence, maybe her fate hasn't been sealed yet. Anne turns her head and sees beady-eyed Thomas Cromwell staring at her from the edge of the platform. Cromwell is Henry's right-hand man, and he's been on team Bring Down Anne for a while now. She wouldn't be here if Cromwell hadn't been on the sidelines filling Henry's head with lies. But Anne doesn't look away from Cromwell. Instead, she glares back at him. She wants this troll to remember his mistake for the rest of his life. Attendants come forward and remove Anne's cloak and hood. Her hair falls to her shoulders, and she tucks it into a white cap to leave her neck exposed. Anne shivers and looks up at the cold, gray sky. She turns toward the castle one last time, searching for her husband. There's no way Henry will let her die, right? But the executioner's shadow falls across the gallows, and Anne realizes the moment is here, and no one is coming to save her. From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Royals, where we bring you true stories of the world's kings, queens, and all the wannabes in their orbit.
It's a show about pulling back the gilded curtain.
Because despite the whole anointed by God thing, royals are just like us.
They have messy breakups, backstabbing frenemies, and workplace drama.
Only theirs end in wars, beheadings, and sometimes the fall of dynasties. All that glitters is in gold. This is the first of our two episodes on Anne Boleyn, the fiery lady-in-waiting who climbed all the way up the ladder to become Queen of England. But just because she had the king's love didn't mean the rest of England was ready to accept her. Despised, shamed, and slandered, Anne Boleyn still managed to rise above all the haters and secure the crown, and paved the way for religious reform in the process. But when you're at the mercy of an insecure and jealous king, your fate is in dangerous hands. This is Anne Boleyn, Part 1. Okay, let's jump back 23 years to the summer of 1513. We're in Brussels at the palace of Queen Margaret of Austria. 12-year-old Anne Boleyn is dancing with the other ladies of court in a great hall. And while every other woman is a picture of beauty and grace, Anne looks awkward in her stiff new dress. It's giving Princess Diaries Renaissance version and not the Beyoncé kind. Anne's trying her best, but she keeps tripping over her feet. She thanks God when the music finally ends and she can scurry off to the side for a breather. Anne has come here from England to learn French and the sophisticated ways of court. It may seem trivial, but dancing is the thing ladies do at court. It's the best way to get noticed by important people, including any eligible bachelors who might be hanging around, which is, I'm sure, why you took up tap.
Absolutely.
But Anne isn't focused on getting a bachelor right now. She's too worried that people will notice how bad she is at this whole court thing. The other ladies make dancing look easy, and they always seem to know exactly when to speak and what to say. Meanwhile, Anne's got two left feet and blurts out whatever's on her mind. But she's put a lot of pressure on herself to master all this stuff. Her family were peasants just a few generations ago, and her dad's been very clear to all three of his children. They should rise above their station. Don't just hang out with the rich. Get in with the royals. But Anne isn't here just to please her dad. It's the early Renaissance, and women don't have a lot of control over their lives. So much different than now.
Yep.
Anne knows if she can marry a noble of higher standing, she'll have the clout to call her own shots. But to do this, she'll need to overcome her provincial English upbringing and learn the sophisticated ways of a foreign court. Anne straightens herself up. She's not going to let a couple of dance steps keep her down. Just because she feels like an outsider doesn't mean anyone else needs to know that.
Fake it till you make it.
Exactly. And she does that. She slaps on a fake smile and gets back on the dance floor. No one puts Anne in a corner. Anne lives a busy life in Brussels. Over the next year, she learns French and Latin and finally nails those court dances. She also masters the art of courtly love, which is the 16th century royal version of flirting. Which I guess we still say courting today, technically.
Yeah, I guess. We're in our boomer era.
We are. So it basically consists of the gentlemen at court giving the ladies gifts and poems, which is definitely an upgrade to some guys just texting, "You up?"
You can say that again.
Anne learns how to banter, bat her eyelashes, and blush with the best of them. After a while, all her hard work pays off, and she's invited to join the court of the Queen Consort of France, a.k.a. the big leagues. Because, Arisha, just like you, Anne wants to be a French girl.
And painted like one.
Yes. Anne dives right in and spends almost 7 years serving the French queen. Not only does she learn how to be très chic, she also learns about religion and politics. Anne takes inspiration from the Queen of France, who runs a virtuous and pious court. Which I gotta say, I honestly thought France was racier than that. When Anne's 20, her father calls her back home. It's time to find a man and get married. He's really starting her late.
Yeah, seriously,
like 20? Wow.
She's basically looking for a nursing home at this point.
Yeah. She gets a new gig as lady-in-waiting for the Queen of England, Catherine of Aragon.
Oh, my girl.
Which gives her the perfect husband hunting ground. Everything that Anne's learned about killing it at court has been building up to this. Now she's ready to seize the moment and kickstart her life. Five months later, 21-year-old Anne is in a palace in London, excitedly watching courtiers entering a huge hall. She's up in a tower, which is part of an elaborate theater set. She's wearing a satin gown with jewels across the chest that spell out perseverance. A few years back, Anne would have been freaking out about performing in front of a big audience. But she learned a lot of tricks back in France, including poise. Anne is part of today's court pageant called Château Vert. She's one of 8 ladies playing different virtues, hence the word perseverance on her dress. The theme of the play is unrequited love.
Oh, theme of my life.
I know, but it's kind of ironic since 30-year-old Henry treats court like his own personal Tinder.
Yeah.
And since he's a king, he's not exactly getting shot down.
I know. I'm an idiot.
Someone needs to.
Seriously, I would love for him to try and court me and I'd be like, pass, hard pass.
Now, Anne looks over at another tower where her sister Mary is playing the role of kindness. Mary is basically a breathing heart eye emoji looking down at the king as he takes a seat in the front row. Anne rolls her eyes. She knows all about how Henry and Mary have been hooking up since Mary arrived at court a few years ago. Mm. When Anne sees Henry greeting everyone, she kind of gets the appeal. He's tall with a sexy beard and a broad chest. The crowd parts for him like magic.
Well, he's the king.
That's a good point.
It's not magic. It's just being servant.
Someone should trip him, though.
I know.
Whoopsie. Oof. His court might be backwoods compared to France, but the man's got what the kids call serious riz.
Riz, no.
And Anne would be lying if she said she didn't notice his calves. Henry may cheat on his wife, Catherine, but he does not cheat on leg day.
Oh, my God.
This guy's actually very proud of his calves.
It's probably the one body part that isn't messed up from incest.
Yeah, probably. A herald steps forward and starts the show. Anne pushes Henry out of her mind. She shouldn't be focusing on the king anyway. There are lots of eligible bachelors in the crowd to impress. Emphasis on the word eligible.
Yep.
The show starts when a man playing the role of Ardent Desire rushes on stage to save Anne and the other virtues. They're being guarded by actors playing Jealousy and Scorn. Anne lets out a loud gasp and raises her hand to her forehead, playing the classic damsel in distress. The audience eats it up. And Anne realizes she loves the spotlight. And Arisha, this is something you and I talk about all the time. Like, there's just something intoxicating about commanding an audience's attention, you know?
Oh, yeah.
As Anne looks out at all the smiling faces, she's like, I could get used to this feeling. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning, Anne knocks the socks off the English court with her sophistication and boldness. She's like that friend who did a semester in Europe and starts every story with, when I studied abroad.
And she knocked their socks off? She didn't get invited to parties. Be like, okay, no one cares.
I know. Pretty soon, Anne catches the attention of a young nobleman at court named Henry Percy. They start talking and flirting, and before long, Anne is falling in love. It helps that Percy is the heir to the Earl of Northumberland, which is a fairly big deal. And more importantly, Percy is Anne's choice, not her dad's. But it turns out Percy's got serious competition. Anne doesn't know it yet, but the king has definitely noticed her, and he's smitten. He loves how bold and exotic she is. Remember those study abroad vibes?
Is that what we're calling exotic these days?
Apparently.
Wow, you went to a country that has people that look just like us? So cool.
Now, by this point, Henry has dumped her sister Mary, and pretty soon he orders his chief minister to tell Percy to back off. And Percy complies. Anne is crushed. At this point, she doesn't know Henry is behind Percy dropping her. All she's been told is that Cardinal Wolsey, the king's chief minister, had something to do with it.
Wolsey.
Yeah, remember old pal Wolsey.
Weasel Wolsey.
Yes! And Anne doesn't like being controlled by anyone, which makes Wolsey her new sworn enemy.
He's mine, too.
Mine, too. I have a lot of enemies in this story.
I do, too.
Meanwhile, Henry starts to make his intentions known. He makes a point of bowing to Anne at events, and she catches him staring at her. When he makes small talk with her in court, there's definitely a vibe. But as far as Anne's concerned, there's nowhere for this relationship to go. She's not going to be a mistress. Anne wants to get married, and that's not something Henry can offer. Henry's got a wife already, and divorce doesn't really exist in 16th century England. So, Anne tries to avoid fantasizing about a future with the king and tries to focus on the fun of being the center of attention instead. The problem is, this kind of attention is gonna get complicated fast. Mm-hmm. About 5 years after Anne makes her debut at the English court, she does something she never thought she would do. She's sneaking through the gardens of the Royal Palace in London, on her way to a secret meeting with the king.
Come on, Anne.
I know. She's not doing anything wrong, but she doesn't want anyone getting the wrong idea about her and Henry.
Mm-hmm.
Anne takes her religion seriously, especially the part about thou shalt not commit adultery. Plus, she's still focused on finding a husband. Suitors will back off if they think she and Henry are involved. Nobody wants to steal the king's girlfriend. Anne finds Henry waiting for her by a golden lion statue. She's got to admit, the man does know how to fill out a doublé.
Okay. I'll take her word for it.
I know. But she's got to get it together. Yes, she's attracted to him. And yes, flirting is fun. But they haven't slept together, and Anne intends to keep it that way. She's holding a love letter from Henry. He sent her a dozen of them in the past few months. What started as a pretty standard flirtmance has devolved into a full-blown obsession. Henry tells Anne that he misses her, but letters aren't enough for him anymore. He wants to take things to the next level, physically.
Okay. Why doesn't he reach out to his wife?
I know. Anne knew this was coming. She's heard a lot of rumors about all of Henry's lovers, Bessie Blount, Madge Shelton, and of course her own sister Mary. Anne knows she has to choose her next words carefully. So she tells Henry that she's fond of their conversations, but as much as she loves flirting, she has to leave it at that. But Henry is used to getting what he wants. So he ignores this and pulls Anne into his arms. She gently pushes Henry away and tells him, bottom line, she doesn't want a fling. She wants a ring.
And then she breaks into Single Ladies, right?
Yeah. There's a reason we call her Anne Beyonce Boleyn. But Henry is like, babe, be real. We both know that can never happen. So Anne snaps back and says, then I guess it's not going to happen.
Damn, girl, get it.
Yeah. And she knows what she just said was out of line. I mean, you can't talk to the king like that. But to her relief, Henry laughs. He actually seems to like how outspoken she is. He thinks it's sexy.
He's like, I love a feisty girl.
Yes, exactly. Henry nods at Anne and gives her permission to leave. She curtsies and rushes off. She doesn't want to be another notch on Henry's belt. She saw firsthand how he ditched her sister, and she doesn't want that for herself. But a part of Anne worries that Henry won't actually back off, that his desire is too big to just be shut down. Because what a king wants is usually what a king gets, which means this fun little flirtation may have just gotten really serious. Anne was right. Henry's attention keeps scaring off her potential suitors. And even though she's attracted to him, she's sticking to her guns. So she finally decides to leave court. If she can't shake this guy, she'll just remove herself from the equation.
Good for her.
Yeah. After several quiet months in the country, Anne thinks Henry has finally moved on. So she's shocked when she gets a message from him giving her exactly what she wanted. A marriage proposal. He says he's asking the Pope to annul his marriage to Catherine ASAP. Now, Anne is shocked, and Henry's not messing around. The plan is already in action. He's going to lean on Cardinal Wolsey to work his magic on the Pope. And if he convinces the Pope to approve the annulment, then he and Anne can get married for real. This news finally makes Anne admit to herself that she does have real feelings for Henry. Feelings that go beyond just attraction. All those months of romantic pursuit have made her soft. Plus, she thinks the way Henry wields power to get what he wants is hot. It's something she'd like to try out for herself. This marriage could change everything. She would get to do right by God and get her man. So, she accepts Henry's proposal the way you do in the 16th century. By sending him a toy ship with a woman wearing a diamond necklace on board.
Oh, yes, of course. Duh.
Of course, we all know that. Now, Henry is a romantic, so he loves the symbolic gift. The ship means protection, which is him. And the damsel on board is Anne. Anne has found her match, and it's beyond anything she ever imagined. I mean, sure, the king is still married, but Henry tells Anne not to worry. He knows God is mad at him for marrying Catherine. That's why he hasn't given Henry any sons. The Pope will obviously see this and want to rectify the situation. Anne knows that ousting Catherine of Aragon is going to ruffle some feathers, but that's not enough to make her back away from this chance at the top spot. Because Anne's about to go from being on the sidelines of the English court to being at the absolute center. It's more power than she's ever imagined. And suddenly, a future that Anne didn't dare to dream of is about to become something she can't live without. All that glitters is in gold. It's late fall 1528, over a year since Anne accepted Henry's proposal. Anne is in her bedroom at her parents' house eating breakfast. She's been staying away from court until the Pope makes a decision on Henry's marriage. This way, nobody can accuse them of doing anything improper. But she hasn't seen Henry for weeks, and she misses him. And his calves. Her prayers are answered when her bedroom door suddenly swings open and Henry walks in. Anne jumps up and hugs him and then buries her face in his chest. Apparently, she's in the I just love how he smells phase of the relationship.
Which is saying a lot because back then they bathed, what, once a month?
Yeah, there's no cologne or deodorant. It's like, it's just his pheromones. Gross.
I love your musty, cheating scent.
You smell like other women. I love it.
Yeah.
The two of them haven't slept together yet, but they were very likely fooling around in other ways. Mm-hmm. In one of Henry's letters, he wrote that he longed to kiss her pretty duckies. Duckies, of course, being slang for breasts.
Nothing makes breasts sound sexier than calling them ducks.
I know. Anne invites Henry to grab whatever the early Renaissance version of a bagel is. But Henry says they need to talk. Anne knows it can't be good news, because this man never turns down a meal. Henry explains that he just spoke with Cardinal Wolsey, and it's looking like the Pope won't be annulling his marriage. Anne's mind starts to race. She knows this all comes down to Wolsey. If he was really on Team Anne, then he would find a way to convince the Pope. Anne feels like he's trying to screw her over again, just like the whole Henry Percy thing. But Anne decides that if Henry's not going to make moves, she'll just have to make them for him. She puts her hand under Henry's chin and tells him they're going to be together, no matter what. Then Henry says the absolute last thing she wants to hear. If being queen isn't possible, why doesn't Anne just become his official mistress?
Oh my God, what an honor.
It's a dream. When you add official in front of it, it's like, I know. Romance.
She can put that in her Instagram handle.
Yep.
The official mistress. People love putting official in there.
They do. Thankfully, Anne goes off. She tells Henry that she will never be just his mistress. And if he's going to cave so easily, then maybe he's not the man she thought he was.
Yeah, I could have told you that and saved you all this trouble, Anne.
Yeah. Henry is an impressionable guy, and Anne knows he responds to displays of strength, so she has to be tough. She can tell from the look on Henry's face that she said the right thing to light a fire under his ass. She loves how powerful she feels right now. She may not be queen yet, but she can still act like one. It's the summer of 1529, and Anne is rushing across the grounds of the royal palace looking for Henry. She's holding a book close to her chest like it's the most precious thing in the world. She finds Henry in the stables, just back from a hunt. And knowing this guy, I'm not really sure if we're talking about animals or women.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with women.
Yeah, that's the safer bet. It took several months, but Anne found the answer to all their problems. After she put her foot down, Henry told Wolsey to get the annulment done, like, now. But unfortunately for him, it wasn't that easy. For one, everyone loves Catherine of Aragon, including us.
Yeah, we do.
And they also love her at court and abroad. So Anne had to take matters into her own hands and get a little creative in the process. Anne hands the book to Henry, and he reads the title, The Obedience of the Christian Man. Henry's like, great, I'll add it to my nightstand. Anne rolls her eyes and flips to a bookmark. Henry's eyes dart across the page, and his eyebrows fly up. The book is clearly inflammatory. It says there's no pope in the Bible, and only kings are next to God.
Oh, God.
In other words, Henry is closer to God than the pope, which means he doesn't need to wait around for the pope's permission on his marriage or anything else.
Who wrote this? Her?
Yeah, he's like, wow, this handwriting looks just like your letters.
Jesus.
Henry slams the book shut and hands it back to Anne. It's dangerous stuff. But Anne isn't afraid. In fact, she thinks there's a lot about the Catholic Church that needs to change. So when she heard about a new book that criticized the Pope, she got her hands on a copy.
Wow, she's an interesting type of devout Christian. I'll say that.
Yeah, I was thinking the same. She knows Henry's afraid of God's wrath. That's why he won't just leave Catherine. He needs to find spiritual loopholes. Anne assures him that this no Pope stuff isn't some wild theory. It's a biblical fact. Henry can end his marriage and marry Anne, and it's all God approved.
Mm-hmm.
She's done her homework. He just needs to trust her. Henry is relieved. And honestly, so is Anne. After feeling powerless for years as a young woman at court, real power and the stability that comes with it is so close. And Anne won't let it slip through her fingers. A few months later, Anne is enjoying a lavish banquet at court in London. The wine is flowing, the ladies are dancing, and everyone is having a great time. Yes, Henry's still married to Catherine, but he's been spending less and less time with the queen lately, meaning Anne and Henry are free to make googly eyes at each other at court parties.
Oh, thank God.
I know, I was worried.
Me too.
Still, it hasn't been all smooth sailing. Anne's had to get her hands dirty to try to make her wedding happen. Because even after reading the book, Henry was still holding out hope that Wolsey would convince the Pope to annul his marriage. After months of no progress, Anne finally made a move against Wolsey. She put together a book of accusations claiming that he was more loyal to the Pope than to his own king. And then she gave it to Henry.
This girl should get into book publishing.
I know. Seriously.
She's like, you know what? I want to change somebody's mind. I'm going to write a book about it.
Yeah. And this was a very bold move. But Anne knows how Henry responds to boldness. She wants him to see Wolsey the way she does, as a big old royal cock block. Trumpets blare as the king enters the hall. Anne joins the receiving line. After everyone's done saying hello, Henry pulls her aside. He's just spoken with Wolsey. She starts to tell Henry that Wolsey's a snake, but the king interrupts her. He says Wolsey made one too many mistakes, and Henry dismissed him.
Wow.
Anne can't believe it. If Wolsey's gone, there's no one to argue the Catholic side to Henry, which means Henry is choosing Anne over the church. Henry takes a seat at the head of the banquet table. Anne tries to keep herself from jumping up and cheering. It won't be long before she's seated next to Henry, as his wife and his queen. Anne's takedown of Wolsey jumpstarts the annulment process. But now Henry's not just leaving his wife, he's leaving the Catholic Church too. And he's taking all of England with him. Now, Arisha, I'm sure you remember from literally last week, he's going to establish an entirely independent church. And who could forget the genius name he gave it? The Church of England.
Just original thinking.
So clever. Yeah. The problem is, the English clergy doesn't exactly love this. They're being branded as renegades by Rome. They also don't want to, you know, go to hell. So they threaten to fight Henry's self-appointment. Enter Henry's new chief advisor, Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell is the slipperiest lawyer in England. He used to work for Cardinal Wolsey, so Anne was probably suspicious of Cromwell from the get-go.
Yeah.
But Cromwell is smart. He can see that Henry will do anything for Anne. So for now, Cromwell is on her side. He tells the clergy he'll take their money and land if they don't fall in line. And the clergy are like, say less, and basically start waving a giant foam finger that says Church of England on it. Now, as we know from our Catherine of Aragon episodes, it turns out it's not just the English clergy who aren't on board. Other Europeans are freaked out by it as well. They don't want to piss off the Pope. So they're like, you want to rethink this one, bud?
God.
This throws Henry off. We all know how impressionable he is, and he's not trying to make more enemies. But Rome is already pissed at him. If the courts of Europe don't accept Anne as a legitimate queen, it could seriously mess with his diplomatic ties. Anne is furious. She's done all this behind-the-scenes work, and she still isn't queen. And that's when she realizes she can't make these changes behind the scenes. She needs to leave England and go on a European goodwill campaign.
Hmm.
It's time to use all that charm she learned in France and turn her enemies into friends. All that glitters is in gold. It's the fall of 1532, 4 years since Henry proposed to Anne, which is honestly an impressive amount of patience on Anne's part. I mean, you and I lose our shit when Postmates is 10 minutes late.
I know.
We're like, we are dying of hunger.
Yeah.
31-year-old Anne is leading a group of ladies into a ballroom. She's wearing a gold and crimson gown and mask set, and she knows she looks good. She loves that everyone is looking at her. Today, Anne is across the channel in the French region of Calais. She was just a lady-in-waiting when she left France 11 years ago. Now, she's almost a queen. Henry is in France as well for an important summit with the French King Francis. But you know who's not with him? Catherine. So while Henry may be trying to smooth over relations with France, Anne has a different goal in mind. To show Europe that she's legitimate queen material. Anne's ladies work the crowd, looking for French nobles to dance with. But Anne locks her eyes on a bigger prize, King Francis. She walks right up to him and curtsies. She certainly looks like royalty. Henry demanded that Catherine fork over some of her jewelry, and he gave it to Anne.
So insanely f***ed up.
I know. Anne looks up at Francis from behind her mask. She takes his hand, and they start to dance. Anne knows Francis is measuring her up, and from the smile on his face, she can tell that she's passing. If only all people were this easy to convince. Anne moved into Henry's palace about 3 years ago. It was a huge step, but she hasn't let herself fully enjoy it because Catherine's supporters hate Anne. Mm-hmm. They only blame her, not Henry, for this whole mess.
Of course, it's never the man's fault. Don't be ridiculous.
Exactly. They call Anne things like concubine and the she-devil.
Wow. The originality of all these insults is just inspiring.
Back then, it was scathing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But getting rejected by Catherine's court only makes Anne fight harder. And she's sick of Catherine standing in her way. It's been 8 years since Henry stopped sleeping with Catherine. And Anne is like, time to move on and move over, or I will sleep in the middle.
I know.
Plus, Anne knows that the king needs a son. Francis twirls Anne. She teases the king in French and asks if that's all he's got. Francis's eyes get wide. He's not used to that. Anne's stomach drops. She just made a major faux pas. And he's like, you're what the French call les incompétents. No, but Francis actually says he's just not used to hearing such perfect French from an English lady. Anne is like, got him. She says that she only felt comfortable because Francis has made her feel so at home. And Francis eats this up and tells her they have much to talk about.
This makes guys seem so easy to woo. So what am I doing wrong?
Have you tried speaking French?
Mais oui, of course.
So Anne glances over at Henry, and he's watching her with pride. There might be two queens in the English court right now, but Anne is the one who's here to stay. The Calais trip is a win for Anne and Henry. Francis agrees to sign a treaty with England. It's exactly the boost they need. Having assurances from a powerful monarch adds to Anne's legitimacy. She is overcome with relief. And even though she isn't technically married yet, she finally sleeps with Henry.
Is this like the kids in like college are like, we haven't had sex, but they've done literally everything else?
Yeah, like I'm sure they've done over the...
over the pants stuff?
Over the garter stuff. Yeah. But for Anne, sleeping with Henry means they definitely need to get married, like right now. Which they do, in secret. Technically, Henry's still married to Catherine at this point, even if he sees the marriage as invalid.
I mean, even if they're in secret, God sees. So much for that pious life.
I know. Henry is waiting on his new bishops to get their ducks in a row.
Their breasts?
Yeah. Gotta get their boobies in a row. Meanwhile, Anne wants to shout it from the rooftops that she's Henry's wife. But she has to wait a few months to shout, I finally married a bigamist who is boinking anything with a hole. Romance isn't dead.
What a dream. Lucky gal.
Yeah, I assume she'd shout that.
Yeah, of course.
Anne's hoping that people will accept her. Henry loves her, and she's charmed the king of France, so she doesn't understand why everyone else can't just accept it. But when they finally announce their marriage at court, a lot of people are pissed. They still love Queen Catherine, who's a refined lady and a devout Catholic. To them, Anne is just a harlot who slithered her way into power. And now she's pissing off God and bringing them all down with her. It must have been hard for Anne to finally get what she wanted, but never win over the public. She thought becoming queen would give her power and control over her own life.
Well, it's silly because it's like, did that work for Catherine? Like, the woman you're replacing? Why do you think it's going to work for you?
I know. That's very true. But Anne knows that that power is useless, unless she can convince her own people that she's not just some ladder-climbing hussy. Five months after Anne and Henry's secret wedding, Anne is traveling in a royal parade down the streets of London. The white and gold cloths she's wearing are heavier than she thought they would be, and kind of scratchy. But she catches herself. No complaining today. Today is her day. Or rather, it's day three of her four-day coronation. Anne looks out at the crowds who've gathered along the Thames. She has to keep pinching herself. After all these years, she finally pulled it off. In just a few minutes, she'll arrive at Westminster Hall, where tomorrow, she'll be crowned Queen of England. Anne hasn't had much time to think. It's been a whirlwind couple of days, with ceremony after ceremony. It's kind of giving those people who celebrate their birthday for a whole month, if I'm being honest.
So me?
Yeah. But Anne and Henry aren't just blowing this thing out because they like to party. Just like in France, they need to show England that Anne is queen material. It's more of an uphill battle here, because Anne is so hated. Henry and Cromwell want to present Anne as the Virgin Mary 2.0. That's why she's draped in white. Oh, and there's another similarity between her and Mary. Anne is 6 months pregnant.
With Jesus?
Yeah. Yes. The second coming.
Oh my God.
Anne rubs her belly. She can't get enough of doing that. She can't say for sure, but it feels like she's carrying a little king-to-be.
Yeah, I bet it does.
Yeah, well, at least she hopes so, because Anne's convinced that if she has a boy, the public will forgive her and finally forget Catherine. The procession rolls to a stop in front of the huge Gothic building of Westminster Hall, which is surrounded by a giant crowd. Footmen help Anne down from the carriage and bow to her. Anne nods regally the way she thinks a queen should. But when she looks at the crowd, she sees they're not looking at her like she's a queen. In fact, a lot of them are glaring at her. And most of the men haven't even taken their hats off. Now, I know this might not seem like a big deal in 2024, but back then it was basically the same as giving Anne the finger.
Mm.
Anne is pissed. Like, how dare they? But her courtly training does not fail her. Instead of throwing a fit, she smiles gracefully. Just like she's been doing since she was 12. Getting mad will only show everyone they're getting to her. She lifts her head high and walks toward her pending coronation. But it's hard to ignore the voice in her head telling her that no matter how grand her coronation is, people still think she's the great whore. Anne realizes that her real challenge is yet to come. Because it's not just about getting to the throne. It's about staying on it. This is the first episode in our two-part series on Anne Boleyn.
You can follow us, your hosts, on socials, at Arisha Skidmore Williams and at Brooke Ziffrin.
We use many sources when researching our stories, but we especially recommend The Life and Death of Anne Boleyn by Eric Ives and the Anne Boleyn Collection 1 and 2 by Claire Ridgway. I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore Williams. Andrew Barbeau wrote this episode, story editing by Michaela Bly, and sound design by Sam Ada. Our associate producer is Hannah Ward. Our coordinating producer is Taylor Sniffen, and our managing producer is Sophia Martins. Rachel Engelman and Julie Magruder are our producers, and our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman, Ginny Bloom, Marsha Louie, and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery.